From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Eric, Mark, welcome back.
Pleasure. Don, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah.
Don, thanks for having us.
Mark, thanks for being here, guys. Okay. I guess Eric this week, you go first.
Perhaps.
The shoot down of a Russian fighter by the Turkish Air Force.
Yeah, this is crazy. I mean, this is really crazy that it's come to this point. I suppose we should probably say it's certainly not surprising. I don't think that any of the three of us were totally taken, you know, off guard that something like this would happen. But I guess it's the manner in which it happened, and I guess the sort of vulgarity with which the Turks did this that is a little bit surprising.
The historical context too. Let me just ask. I mean, sure. I don't remember. I'm remembering back to the Cuban Missile Crisis when I was 8 years old. I don't remember a NATO ally shooting down a Soviet or Russian plane.
I can't name in a single time that's happened.
Evidently, it happened in the 1950s.
I remember Francis Gary Powers getting shot down.
Yeah, but that's the Soviets shooting him down over Soviet airspace. That's a whole different scenario.
And there was a big deal over that. The United States was all blustery and ready to kick butt over that, as I recall.
Yeah, well, in any event, you know, I think that this is certainly an escalation. I don't really know where we should begin with this issue, so I guess I'll just throw out a couple of ideas and bounce that off Mark and you, Don. I think first and foremost, we should obviously have, you know, our sympathies to the family of the pilot who was killed, obviously, and certainly I think all of us would probably share the sentiment that de-escalation is the best thing that could happen. We certainly
there was also a Russian Marine killed in the rescue.
In the rescue mission, exactly. Yes. Then I think we should probably all also obviously say that we're all interested in peace and making sure that this doesn't turn into something bigger. However, I think it is already much bigger than...
We're well past that point.
Yeah,
we're well past that point.
So the issue now becomes, why would Turkey do this? Now, obviously, I think first and foremost is the fact that Russia was destroying in a very significant way a lot of that terrorist infrastructure that Erdogan and the Turkish intelligence had diligently helped to build up since 2011. That really, the entire Turkish-Syrian border and especially key pockets of the border, key transit points, these have really been the focus of much of the terrorist activity since this war began. These are the points at which a lot of these terror groups, be they al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, the Army of Conquest, all of these various groups that have been transiting back and forth across the Turkish-Syrian border. Now, obviously, as we know, as we've discussed many times, what do they do in Turkey? They get medical facilities, you know, medical support. They get their ammunition, their weapons. They meet with the advisors who are obviously there. We know, as the New York Times documented in 2012, that the CIA and the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood are right there on the border, sending in the weapons, training, or at least helping the fighters to filter into the country and so forth. So the border region, I think, is very significant, and it shouldn't come as a surprise that the Russian jet was shot in this border region. Now, it should be remembered, of course.
Before you finish it, because this is dramatic.
Real quick,
let's describe the entire incident, because we had first the shoot down of the plane and then the shooting at the pilots from the ground, the killing of one of them, and then the piling on to the rescue mission, all of that in that same territory.
Yes, and we'll definitely get to it. I just want to make this point, though, because it's something that's not discussed in the media narrative about this. The very fact that Turkey long ago already, multiple years ago, moved their quote-unquote their border 5 kilometers into Syria. So when Turkey says that this jet violated Turkish airspace and crossed over the border, the question becomes, did it really cross over the Turkish border, or did it cross over this artificial safe zone that the Turks created that is 5 kilometers into Syria? That question, I think, is still unanswered, and Erdogan and his government have quite a lot to answer for, even if the jet crossed into Turkish territory for those 17 seconds. So, yes, exactly as you said, Don, obviously there's more to this story, but I bring up this fact because it gives us a window into this larger war that's happening here. Turkey has been infringing upon Syria's territory since the beginning, and that has to factor into this narrative.
Yeah, I'm just, the reason I brought it up, and Mark, you could go to this if you like, or wherever, is that, you know, there's been an awful lot of parsing of who's a principal and who's an agent in general in Syria. And I think as the facts come out about these incidents, because there are three incidents, you've got the shoot down of the plane, the murder of the pilot against the Geneva Conventions, and then the pile-on against the rescue mission. Okay, all of those take place in that same territory that is also the area that the United States had been saying a few weeks ago they wanted to create a no-fly zone over, a buffer zone out of. In other words, the piece of Syria, the real estate that they wanted to take.
Well, and Turkey has already de facto done that. That's my point, is that they have already said that they've done that, this 5 kilometer zone.
Right.
So it's really just a matter of formalizing
right.
it.
So my point is, so who's a principal and who's an agent if it's Turkish-controlled territory? It's all Turkey, in other words, that did these violations, whether themselves or by their agents.
Is that for me or Mark?
I guess Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, let's start a little bit earlier to provide context for this. In August of 2013 began the Latakia Offensive, in which an attempt to take off pressure from what was then a resurgent Syrian Arab army. There were two more fronts opened against the Syrian government. One of them was in the south of Syria, and this is where the CIA injected their 10,000 plus trained proxies in through Jordan, and that was the southern FSA, the southern offensive. There was a northern Latakia offensive where we call them rebel groups or moderate rebels, and what it really means is al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and FSA groups that are openly allied with al-Qaeda, attacked out of rebel-held Salma, and more to the point, straight across the Turkish border into northern Latakia, which is Alawite majority territory, which is the heartland of the Syrian government. Attacks here, for the first time, really brought the war home to a large portion of the population loyal to the Syrian government that hadn't been directly affected by it. You know, their sons and daughters went off to war, of course, but they themselves hadn't been affected by it. And there was quite a few of these Alawite villages were absolutely systematically ethnic cleansing isn't even the word. It was a genocide. It was a bloodbath, butchery through these. This was reported at the time in mainstream Western sources such as The Guardian and so on. And they were actually, they covered some of the bloody details that actually went on here. But of course, it's all quickly forgotten with the mantra, moderate rebels, moderate rebels, moderate rebels. Well, a lot of the territory they did this out of is an area of northern Latakia, right across the Turkish border, where there is a number of Turkmen, that is, ethnic Turk villages. These Turkmen, some of them, the majority of Turkish press reports that the majority of these Turkmen are Nusra, and the rest of them are FSA allied with Nusra, al-Qaeda. Some of these aren't Turkmen. Evidently, at least one of the leaders, one of them, the deputy commander who evidently shot and killed two of the Russian pilots as they plummeted helplessly in their parachutes, a war crime, is a Turkish citizen a member of the AKP, a member of the Grey Wolves, and the son of a former Turkish mayor. Others of these are Chinese Uyghurs, which are of a Turkish ethnicity, but obviously not from Syria, so not Turkmen. And a number of them are Central Asians, also, again, of Turkish, primordial ancestry, but not Turkmen and not from Syria. So there's a real question of who these people actually are. But as part of the Russian-Syrian Arab strategy for defanging what's going on here, necessitated removing this rebel-controlled area at the very tip of northern Latakia on the Turkish border. They were moving hard against them. There was really hard. They were taking territory, village after village. The combination of the Russian airstrikes and the Syrian Arab army on the ground, supported by Hezbollah and Iranian Shiite militias, was rapidly moving against them. They were sending out YouTube messages pleading with the AKP, with the Turkish government, to do something to save them. They were clearly identifying themselves while doing this as Mujahideen and al-Nusra, al-Qaeda. Erdogan was extremely pissed about this because, again, it went against his plans, as been earlier mentioned, for direct intervention, safe zones and the like. And a week before the shooting of the down of the plane, he summoned the Russian ambassador and complained about these airstrikes and warned them not to continue. Russia ignored, continued on. It hit the Turkish press in a fury the day before the attacks, and then the attacks happened. The night of the attacks, very curiously, Erdogan, in the speech, the public statement he made, veered oddly, completely away from the idea of penetrating the airspace argument, which is completely false. But he said, we had a right to defend our Turkmen kinsmen. And that tells you what this is all really about there.
Yep.
Erdogan and the United States were pissed that Russia and the Syrian Arab army were wiping out their proxies in the area. Now, on top of that, the reported in Sputnik from the Lebanese media, some of the special forces that the U.S. recently sent to train anti-ISIS rebels were actually sent to Latakia, where they were training these Turkmen. And we know that for a fact because the weapon that they then used to down the search and rescue helicopter, it was already down on the ground, but they destroyed it, in which one of the Russian Marine was killed, was a U.S.-made tow weapon. They filmed themselves quite professionally, not with a cell phone camera, doing it. They assembled it, a complete professional, fired it while yelling Allahu Akbar, and then went the Russian search and rescue helicopter.
Yeah, can I want to interject a couple of points here as well, because everything Mark said is true and very important, but it almost makes it seem like this is the one place where this is happening. And in fact, I know that's not what Mark was implying, but just so that people...
No, this is one detail.
Right, get a sense of this issue. The Turkish military has actually made several incursions inside of Syria in that region. And while Latakia, they have these proxies, these Turkmen groups working with U.S. Special Forces. The CIA is over there as well. This we know. But also, if you go east in Idlib province has been a stronghold for a lot of these rebel groups for quite a while now. And Idlib, we have reports. In fact, I talked to two eyewitnesses who confirmed each other's stories on this, that in 2014 and again in early 2015, there were multiple instances where the Turkish military actually provided air cover, using helicopter gunships, air cover for al-Nusra Front and these other groups in Idlib, which is one of the other places where the Syrian Arab Army was making its counteroffensive against the terror groups. And so, in fact, what Mark is saying is, in many ways, only the tip of the iceberg of a larger objective that the Turkish military has had throughout that region, namely providing the space, clearing the way for these terror groups to be able to operate and to expand this war. And that is, again, another reason why Turkey is so upset with Russia and Russia's mission, because it prevents Turkey's military from intervening on behalf of these terror groups. And that's obviously one of the most potent weapons that the Turks have. Let me also say this, that a lot of these towns where Mark is, that Mark is talking about, where you saw this bloodbath, this was not a one-time bloodbath. Many of these towns have essentially lived under siege, in a state of siege, for months, if not more than 2 years now, including the Syrian towns of Kafaria and Fua, and I think one or two others, that were living under shelling, under barrage by these and quite literally siege by the al-Nusra Front and some of these other groups. Now, this is the reason I say that, is to give people a sense of the kind of war we're seeing along the Syrian-Turkish border. These are not simply skirmishes. These are long-lasting sieges and massacres. And again, this, of course, reminds us very well of Libya, where in Libya we had, just as Mark was saying, I think very much correctly, that you saw ethnic cleansing on a wide scale that would, I think, very much be tantamount to genocide. Genocidal actions against black Libyans in the south of the country, the Fezzan province, carried out by these jihadi extremists backed by NATO. We're seeing very similar type of activities happening in various parts of Syria, where you have large-scale ethnic cleansing directed against the non-Sunni sects.
You know, you have like almost like a fractal war going on the one hand, and also like a fractal public relations portrayal of the war going on. It is the phenomenon that Mark was describing, that you were just adding to, in the north. Everywhere that there's fighting going on, somebody has a legitimate reason, quote unquote, for being on the ground that's being rolled out now. The Turks are protecting their Turkmen brothers in Latakia. The U.S. is protecting the moderate rebels and threatening to, you know, intervene on their behalf if they're attacked by the Russians, etc., etc. The Turks have a legitimate reason to attack the Kurds as they attack ISIS. Everybody's in there to attack ISIS. And so there's this war going on, and it's portrayed and even being played out as multiple sub-wars, but there's a larger one that obviously is over the fate of Syria.
There's a wonderful cartoon that that I came across, I shared on my Twitter, on my social media. You can check it out this morning, the Anti-ISIS Coalition. And it shows a little cartoonish images of Putin, Assad, the Saudis, the Free Syrian Army, the Kurds, Netanyahu, everyone. They all have a gun in each hand, and they're all pointing it at someone else, and they're all standing around each other, really bringing home the insanity of the interests and the contradictions in all of the sides going on here. Yeah. So I urge you to see that. It's quite amusing, if scary. I have to say that, first of all, don't get the sense that all Turkmen in Syria are what we are talking about. That's here. Because, right, of course, not all Turkmen are bad. There are some Turkmen fighting with the FSA and al-Qaeda. There are some Turkmen who are actually fighting with the Kurds. There are some Turkmen fighting in the Syrian Arab Army. Right. And there are a lot of Turkmen that want nothing to do with any of this. But this, right, in this particular area, however, the groups that the Erdogan regime are trying to protect, these so-called Turkmen groups are they're jihadi. They openly identify themselves as Mujahideen. They did that for the camera, to anyone who wants to try to deny it. And they are definitely guilty of some quite bloody situations in that area there.
Let's
take a look at the legal argument for a second there. Let's assume that the Turkish version of events is correct, which I don't think the overwhelming evidence is wrong. Let's assume that Russia violated Turkish airspace for 17 seconds and Turkey claims they had the right of self-defense to shoot down that plane. There is an excellent piece in the American political journal, The Hill, by a retired Air Force Major General Dunlap, where he quite clearly lays out that even if this was the case, that the very high standard for self-defense and the use of military force, the required amount of proportionality, means that this was not an act of self-defense because Turkey had absolutely no reason to believe, and even they haven't claimed, that this was the Russians were intending to attack Turkey.
They shot it in the back. It was on the way out, if it was there at all. They shot it in the back. Leave.
Yeah. There is a very high requirement for the use of force, determining hostile intent. We know that Turkey routinely violates Syrian airspace nearly every day up until this incident. Bomb the Kurds. They have repeatedly bombed the violated Iraq's airspace and to bomb the Kurds in there, and they did it just 2 days after this incident. They violated Greece airspace 2,240 times last year, and they violated Armenian's airspace this year. Meanwhile, 3 years ago, it was a Turkish airplane shot down for providing air support in northern Syria, Erdogan insisted that a brief incursion could never be justification for the use of force against an airplane. And the Turkish general staff reported that such incidents happen all the time. They're settled normally under international law, and that there could be no excuse for the use of force.
I just want to add really quickly, if I could. I wrote about that. I wrote about the incident with the Turkish jet a couple of years ago. And when I wrote about it, I talked to two military experts who both had experience in the Air Force, who knew about this issue. And both of them said to me pretty much identically that these types of things, these very temporary incursions of airspace of a neighboring country, happen all the time, that this is a very regular occurrence, and that it is never grounds for shooting down the airplane, that especially in conflict zones, especially where you have dozens or hundreds of sorties being flown every day, every week, every month, that to cross over into another country's airspace is considered almost routine, and that no country on earth would really, if they were interested in de-escalating, would ever shoot down a plane for that reason.
Hey, Fox had on a guy who was the local commander of NORAD for the airspace between the Soviet Union and Alaska, and he described many incursions, both by U.S. against the USSR and the USSR against the U.S. without any incident like that.
That it happens all the time, and that the point here, and I didn't mean to cut you off, Mark, I'll let you get back to it, but that the point being that Turkey used a very regular occurrence, if we're to believe the 17 seconds narrative, used this very routine, very mundane thing as a pretext to escalate this conflict.
Distinguish between also the nature of the Turkish incursions into Syria and the nature of the Russian incursion as alleged through Turkey, because Russia was on a mission inside Syria, moving from one spot in Syria to another, and if the Turks have it right, which apparently they don't, then they overflew Turkish airspace as a shortcut for 17 seconds. Wow. The Turks were inside Syria conducting military missions And those military missions are in support.
On U.S. allies, attacking U.S. allies.
U.S. allies, and by the way, while they're conducting this proxy war against the government in Syria as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is what it comes down to, is that the reason I brought it up is because in my mind, this is this salient point here, that Turkey wanted this incident to happen. Turkey premeditated this shoot down of the plane, and that Turkey did it for a very specific reason. And maybe it's it would be helpful if we discussed it, because I don't know that it's 100% clear exactly what Erdogan's strategy here is, what he thought this was actually going to achieve, because he couldn't possibly be so stupid as to think that this would substantively alter what Russia's doing in Syria. He couldn't have believed that.
There's
so he obviously had some other idea.
Hang on one second, Eric. There's a question that Lavrov raised that bears on this point as well. And I'm going now back to the question of principal and agent here, and looking now at Erdogan perhaps as agent. Lavrov said, our allies, our friends, our partners, whatever term he used, have told us that purchase weapons from the Americans, that they are not allowed under the terms of the purchase contracts to use those weapons against third parties without direct permission from Washington. And so he raised the question, either did they have the permission, or did they violate that condition, which is also a condition on, say, the Saudis and the Israelis and everybody else, and now that condition is not operative. Which is it?
Yeah, it goes even a little bit further. So there's the end user agreement, right? That there's the argument that the United States may have required that, because Turkey was using a U.S. F-16 firing a U.S. AIM Sidewinder missile to take down this Russian plane, that they may have been required to seek U.S. permission. There's also the deconfliction agreements for the anti-ISIS coalition, whereby Russia and the U.S. agreed, and the U.S. was responsible for its coalition partners. And supposedly, they should have sought permission through the United States before taking any action here. Right. Even further, the Russian president has revealed that they specifically gave the United States in almost all of their attacks. They informed the United States before they're going to strike, when they're going to strike, and what they're going to strike. And they said they did it on this occasion. And they find it extremely hard to believe that this incident could have happened, since they informed the United States where they were going to be attacking. Right. I find it hard to believe that Turkey could have arranged this attack without the United States knowing about it, deeply embedded in insular air surface. Yep. I mean, they bug Angela Merkel's cell phone. They know what the Turkish military, they are deeply involved. They're patrolling this border there. The U.S. Republican, very reputable Republican realist radio host, John Batchelor, reported on Twitter this week that he has been told that U.S. F-15s were in the area. They were shadowing the Turks. Yeah. They were there to fight back if the Turks came under Russian attack during this mission. That this was indeed a premeditated and planned encounter, that the U.S. was not only fully aware, but complicit and colluded in this. First of all, the immediate effects are helping Erdogan with his domestic political base, which is urging action to protect these Turkmen. Also, a bit of revenge for having his proxies taken, but also help sabotage any possibility of Russian and French agreement. That might take the French position away from the U.S. insistence on regime change with Assad. But even further, I believe, to an incremental escalation. Just this morning, it came out that the U.S. has unofficially, this is always done through anonymous officials speaking to, their usual leak sources in the Western media, that they are pressuring the Turks to close the border where ISIS and these other jihadist groups are getting supplies in the middle of north central Syria, in between these two Kurdish controlled areas. This is the vital supply route from Turkey to Syria, and for oil going back and forth, not only for ISIS, but for al-Nusra, for the FSA, for Jaish al-Fatah, for Ahrar al-Sham, for all of this 31 flavors of jihad up there.
Yeah.
They specifically said that this will take at least 30,000 troops to close this border. Now, this is quite obvious that they are going forward with this. They are going to have a pretext of some kind of attacks or something on their forces on the border, where they will say they need to go across the border and establish a safe zone. And this will be the Turkish incursion into northern Syria to keep open these supply routes and to double down and actually begin this Libya-style operation. I'm quite sure of this.
On Tuesday morning, right after the incident occurred and as Washington was stirring, the regularly scheduled presser from the Department of Defense had Colonel Steve Warren, who's a spokesperson for the military in Syria, U.S. military in Syria. He normally briefs reporters on the operations, and it was scheduled to be about ISIS. Instead, he had to answer questions about the shootdown. And one question was, somebody raised the question about the F-15s in the area and the U.S. command and control of, NATO sorties and, all of the data transfer to and from the U.S. and their surveillance of it and everything else. And he admitted that they had all this stuff, and he was saying, that stuff comes in real time and then we have to analyze it. So to me, it seemed like he was saying, this is never useful operationally, only in terms of forensics, which of course is not true. So that being the case, we're looking at the U.S. being completely plugged into the incident.
Oh, for sure. I don't think that there's any doubt about that. I'd like to shift gears a little bit, since we are limited in time here. I want to talk about another aspect of this, and Mark mentioned it very briefly, but I want to highlight the significance here. The individual who allegedly actually pulled the trigger and killed the pilot who was parachuting out of that jet, and the one who I guess is one of the commanders there of the Turkmen forces, Mark mentioned that he is an AKP member and a member of the Grey Wolves. Okay, now this is an important point here, because the Grey Wolves should be understood. I mean, this is a fascist.
Yeah, his name is Alparslan Selik, for those who want to take a look for it.
And the Grey Wolves are a Turkish supremacist fascist organization, and they are very much mobilized on the side of the Justice and Development Party and Erdogan. And I wrote about this about 2 months ago, and some people kind of made fun of me for saying it. My article was entitled, "Has Turkey Become a Fascist State?" And I said it partially, not entirely suggesting that it is like Mussolini style, corporate fascist state. But this is an important aspect of Erdogan's political machine, namely marshaling and mobilizing Turkish supremacist views, fascist views, in order to be able to more or less control the streets. And ultimately, that is what has happened. These Grey Wolves have done things like burn down Kurdish businesses. They've attacked Kurdish political party headquarters, the HDP party inside of Turkey, which is pro-Kurdish. They have attacked Kurdish people on the streets in Ankara, in other cities and towns throughout Turkey. This is a clear fascist organization. And the reason I highlight this is so that we understand exactly the kind of sentiment that Erdogan is playing on here. Right. So when we say that Erdogan and Davutoglu represent this neo-Ottoman ideology, neo-Ottoman strategy, Turkish expansionism, this is part of what's rooted in that, is this Turkish supremacist mindset. And so Mark highlighted another key point that I want to mention here. The Uyghur, that is from Xinjiang, Western China, what some of these anti-Chinese types say is East Turkistan, right? That's what they call the region.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the reason this is important is because Turkey, in my view, and Turkish intelligence has essentially created an international Turkish or ethnic Turkish terrorist network. Okay, they have funneled Turkish and Turkmen and Uyghur terrorists all throughout the region. This has been shown actually when 10 Turkish citizens were arrested for creating fake passports, fake documents for Uyghur terrorists who got caught in Malaysia and they got caught in the Philippines going through security there with Turkish-made fake passports. Now, these terrorists were going to places like the Afghan-Pakistan border. The organization, the East Turkestan Islamic Militants, the ETIM, East Turkestan is Xinjiang province. That's the Uyghurs. Okay, now, if you have Turkmen and Uyghurs and Turkish citizens all fighting together in one unit on the ground in Syria, what does that tell you about the international capabilities of Turkish intelligence to organize, mobilize, and support terrorism? This is a key point here because Xinjiang province of Western China has been the victim of repeated terrorist attacks over the course of the last 3 years, and it is these Uyghur jihadists who have carried that out. Now, this is a very dangerous point here because the Neo-Ottoman strategy envisions a reunification of all of these ethnic Turkic people stretching from Turkey proper all the way to Western China. That is the psychopathy of Erdogan and his milieu.
And I just want to remind listeners, this is this, and rhetorically ask, is this the same Turkey that's a member of NATO?
Yeah, exactly right.
It is. Eric, you will love this. Under Obama, Islamofascism has actually become a real thing.
Yeah.
In the early days after the Maidan Revolution, the Maidan Putsch in Ukraine, before the Crimean self-defense militias had fully organized and Russia had let its troops off their bases to support them as they declared their independence and then voted in a referendum to reunify with Russia as a response to the change of the government that they had elected, there was a flight scheduled from Turkey that Russian intelligence revealed was carrying a number of Crimean or a number of Tatars, whether they were actually Crimean or not, who had been fighting in Syria. The Turkish military intelligence was sending to the Crimea to help seize control of government buildings there to prevent them from breaking away from Ukraine. When the Russians then reacted and seized control of the airport and the main government building there with the help of the Crimean local self-defense militias, this plane turned around in mid-air and returned to Turkey. Anna Nemtsova, writing in Foreign Policy, 3 months ago, a very anti-Russian, Russian liberal against the Russian government, but she revealed that in Ukraine, there are several members of ISIS fighting in a Islamic brigade funded by the Ukrainian government in Mariupol and in an occupied city in Donbass. And they are quite openly ex-ISIS members.
Yeah.
There's photos of these guys sitting down to lunch on a table outside, sitting down to a tea with the leader of the neo-Nazi right sector, Dmitry Yurosh. And these are ISIS veterans. Now, Azov announced this morning, Azov, the neo-Nazi brigade in Ukraine, announced they want to come to Turkey to Syria to fight with the Turkish government for the Western coalition against Russia. And there is also been announced, it's in the Russian press, that the recent bombing of electricity infrastructure that has plunged the Crimea into a total blackout for more than a week now, which the Ukrainian government refuses to do anything about. And again, we see the right sector and Crimean Tatars of the Mezhlis there. Supposedly, the orders to do this came from Erdogan.
Yeah, and let's not forget also, you have one of the most significant contingents on the ground in Syria fighting under the Islamic State ISIS-Daesh banner are Chechens. So
the main military commander in Syria of ISIS is Omar al-Shashani, who is a ethnic Chechen, a Georgian citizen who was trained by the United States and fought against Russia in the August War in 2008. He is the primary commander of ISIS, military commander of ISIS in Syria.
Yeah. So, you know, and of course, as we know, Syria is, I mean, Mark, you probably are best fit to answer this. What is it, about 20-hour drive from Syria to the Caucasus?
24 hours.
I think you can get from Ingushetia or Dagestan to the battlefield in Syria in under a day's drive. Now, that to me also is obviously it has to factor into Putin's thinking and the thinking of the Kremlin, namely that that is precisely how the West is going to, let's say, fan the flames of conflict into Russia itself. So, you know, I know we've discussed this before, and I think Mark correctly stated that it's not exactly a quote-unquote existential threat to Russia, but it is clearly a terrorist threat to Russia and Russia's national security, and something that they take very seriously. And I think that also part of my point in bringing up all of this stuff about Turkey and about fascism and terrorism is to say that this is one of the imperial, quote-unquote, imperial strategies that Erdogan is employing in pursuit of this neo-Ottoman objective. Because when we talk about neo-Ottomanism, this is not some sort of, you know, construct that we use to, you know, to demonize Erdogan. This is very much out of the mouths of Erdogan and Davutoglu themselves. Yes. And they're the ones who have kind of employed this thinking. And now I want to infuse
this lineup of historical Turkish military outfits as they descend from the presidential steps. It's, you know, something right out of a James Bond movie.
Yeah, right out of a James Bond movie, or right out of, you know, some, you know, Ottoman satrapy or, you know, something like this.
The 17th century, maybe. I mean, and if you look, it goes all the way to Budapest, Algiers, and the Caspian Sea.
Well, and the point that I also want to make here too is that when Turkey is engaging in this sort of let's call it, you know, imperial revanchism, there is an element of, you know, obviously Turkish supremacy in all of this. There is, of course, this historical conflict between the Ottoman Empire and the former Russian Empire over control of the Black Sea and all of this. But
the very important issue right now of the Dardanelles.
The Dardanelles, the Bosphorus, all of these important waterways.
Then the Russian mission in Syria cannot be supported. Russia doesn't have the logistical air power to supply everything that's needed to keep those troops supplied. They need to put military ships through the Dardanelles. That puts Russia in a very difficult geostrategic situation.
Yep.
Yeah, and again, the point here is that what Turkey is actually engaged in, well, first of all, they're fighting multiple wars, right? Let's not forget the Turks are fighting against the Kurds here, and that's a major element here. But one other point that I just want to infuse has to do with who or what Erdogan represents. It's not just neo-Ottomanism, okay? That is the ideological outlook or maybe the end goal. What he really represents is ultimately the Muslim Brotherhood. Erdogan is the Muslim Brotherhood. That's what he comes from. That's his outlook. That is his, his milieu, right? And this is part of the reason why Erdogan is so hell-bent on destroying Assad and removing Assad. Assad, the Assad government, the Ba'ath Party, represents everything that the Muslim Brotherhood wants to destroy. Okay, so when the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey wants regime change, it's not simply that they want to get rid of Assad. They want, in Assad's place, a compliant Muslim Brotherhood aligned government that would be more or less taking its orders directly from Ankara. Now, this tension between Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand and those forces that fight against it, this is one of the critical dynamics all throughout the region. Look at the Sisi versus Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt to understand the importance of the ongoing conflict that between the Muslim Brotherhood. And who backs the Muslim Brotherhood extensively? Of course, obviously Turkey, but Qatar. Qatar is a primary backer of the Muslim Brotherhood. And then the Wahhabi extremist networks backed by the Saudis are mobilized by the Brotherhood in order to affect all of these objectives.
Now you're in Africa, since you're in Egypt, okay? Let's, if we can, unless Mark, you want to reply to that, but I'd like to get, before we run out of time, to what just happened in Mali and relate it to this too.
Okay, let me just finish on that there for a second. I'll let Eric cover Mali because he's far more of an expert on it than me. Putin covered what you're talking about extremely well this week when he said outright, first of all, that Turkey is now a state sponsor of terror. He was quite explicit about that, that they're supporting ISIS, that they ask as an oil launderer, money supply, weapons depot, tourist vacation for jihadis. But also he said that I made a political attack against Erdogan, saying that he is beginning a process, or well along the way of process, of Islamization.
Yeah.
Talking about Islamism, the political structure of a Sharia state in Turkey. When you're talking about there, this plan B for Syria, the creation of a Sunni state between the Syria, what will remain the Syrian government-controlled Latakia coast in Iraq, that will break up this Shiite arc of influence. We've already had neocons, Brookings, break this a long time ago in their paper that everyone should read, Deconstructing Syria. But just again this week, John Bolton in the New York Times, to defeat ISIS, create a Sunni state.
Yes,
James Dobbins in USA Today, partition Syria to crush the Islamic State. You know, the shills, the neocon shills for Syria are out in the papers in full force this week. The one thing I wanted to touch on was Russia's response to all of this. And of course, we're seeing numerous, Russia's response will be overwhelming. It will be multi-vectored. It's not going to be a direct attack on Turkey. That's quite obvious. The Russian government was quite clear about this. There's numerous diplomatic and economic sanctions angles to it. But what I want to touch on, one is the air defense. Russia has moved in, or at least activated, if they were already there, S-400 air defense systems, which will overlap with the nautical version of the S-300 on the Moskva cruiser off of the Syrian coast. This is the Russian no-fly zone over Syria. This will cover all of Syria, all of southern Turkey, down almost all of Israel, Lebanon as well. This is the most advanced air defense system in the world, hands down. It can simultaneously track over 300 targets, engage simultaneously 36 targets, hitting them up to 250 miles away, and it can even take down, it is analyzed, stealth equipment, stealth bombers, and fighters from the United States. It is an extremely potent statement. It is a geopolitical chess piece moved onto the board. And you will note that neither the United States nor Turkey have flown any air missions in Syria since this system has gone online. The other major aspect of Russia's response is they, of course, they eradicated every Turkmen in this area. They bombed them. The Syrian army's moving in strong, as is the Iranian general Soleimani, who evidently helped lead the rescue mission for the pilot that was recovered. Very interesting little detail there this week. But also, Russia is now providing close air support for the Kurds as they move to try to close the Turkish-Syrian border. That is a major step. Expect the YPG to end up with a sudden blue light special on anything within the Russian military arsenal. Erdogan, I think, has made a huge miscalculation because now he has put the Russians and the Kurds, which were already flirting, into bed so furiously that they don't have time to take off their clothes. Kurds are calling to Russians all over the internet, "We will avenge you, we will avenge you, just give us what we need." And the Russians are saying, "Here, here, here." And already Russia, for the first time, is providing close air support for the Kurds as they attack Nusra and Western allied moderate rebels to close this border.
Better.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. I think that's a pretty good summation. Do we want to move to Mali,
yeah,
Don?
Please. Mali, please.
Let's do that, yeah.
Yeah, well, basically, I'm not sure how much time we have left, but in the time that we have remaining, there was a terror attack in Mali Friday. I guess that would have been Friday the 20th. Basically, some armed terror group stormed a Radisson Blue Hotel in the Malian capital of Bamako. 27 people ended up dead, at least 27 by the final count, as far as I know. Now, the reason this is interesting, it got almost no attention. And I mean, to some degree, I guess we can understand it came about a week after what happened in Paris and just before the downing.
First, so they can send people to your article first, so if we run out of time, they can read the whole
sure.
thing.
Sure. I published an article the other day entitled "Terror in Mali: An Attack on Russia, an Attack on China and Russia." And the basic gist of the article, and this is the main point that I want to get across here, is the first three people who were killed in this operation, in this terror attack, were three of the most significant, most senior members of China's Railway Construction Corporation, and they were working in Mali on the construction of a number of strategically critical railroad developments, including a railroad connecting Bamako, the capital of Mali, which is a landlocked country, connecting it with the capital of Guinea in Conakry, a major West African port, and also refurbishing and renovating the railway connecting Bamako, Mali, with Senegal, with the Dakar in Senegal. Now, these important railway projects, among many others, were being handled by China's Railway Construction Corporation. Its top executive from its international division, its top executive and its second executive, so the manager and the deputy manager, were both murdered in this attack, and also the head of their West African operation also murdered. So the three Chinese citizens who were killed in this terror attack were probably the three most significant Chinese people in West Africa. Now, that to me is already raises a number of red flags about this operation. Moreover, six more people who were killed in the first minutes of this attack were six Russian citizens, all of them employees of an airline called Volga Dnieper Airlines. Now, Volga Dnieper Airlines is a cargo airline, and their specialty is the transport of large or irregular sized objects for the purposes of large scale economic development projects. They move things like earth movers and oil rig equipment and military equipment and mini factories and all kinds of these large scale capital goods. Now, it is quite likely, we can't confirm it yet, but it's quite likely that their role, their job in Mali was providing the cargo support, cargo capacity for a lot of these Chinese-led projects, moving the bulldozers, the earth movers, chambers, the oil extraction equipment, the mineral extraction equipment, all of that stuff. So the bottom line here is the attack in Mali, in my view, is a targeted assassination that is a clear and unmistakable message to Russia and to China regarding what they're doing in Africa and also regarding their strategic partnership. In other words, China and Russia will be made to pay a price for challenging Western hegemony in Africa, for challenging Western hegemony throughout the world, and for moving closer together. I don't think that anybody could reasonably assert that it is mere coincidence that at the very moment that this high-ranking Chinese delegation is there meeting in this hotel, that that is the moment that they storm the lobby and execute these people. No way.
When I heard Eric tell me this, my first thought was, can anyone seriously tell me they don't believe that we are in the early days of World War III right now?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about the nature of the project Eric's describing, basically the leg from the center to the west of a Trans-African Railroad and the installation of mineral and oil extraction material that would be cargo carried over it. Just go to what's happening in South America with the Transcontinental Railroad that China plans to build there. And also the Silk Road construction and the project from Beijing to Europe railroad also. This is the most vulnerable outpost of all of that. But it's a message about what the West will do to stop the construction of all of it.
And there's also an interesting symbolic meaning here, because Mali, of course, is a former French colony, but Mali is one country in particular in Africa that has longstanding ties with Russia, with the Soviet Union. A lot of the Malian leadership in the 60s and 70s studied in the Soviet Union. A lot of them have still, you know, at least some residual connection to Russia, although Russia in the last 25 years has really turned away from Africa as far as what the Soviet Union used to do. But the point here is that there is a connection between this former French colony and Russia specifically, and China is a major player there. Now, Mali has a wealth of potential uranium, a wealth of various other very valuable minerals, and also, of course, Mali is potentially a major energy exporter, a major source of energy. So there's a lot of economic reasons. And just as Don, you were alluding to, of course, a railroad that connects a landlocked country to the coast is essential for China and their commercial shipping.
Mark, you got about 90 seconds.
Real quickly, Eric, my last word's a contradiction. Google Russia and Africa. The first pages that come up, national interest revealed, Russia's mighty pivot to Africa. Al Jazeera, Russia returns to Africa in a big way amid increasing isolation. Atlantic Council, countering Russia's return to Africa.
Okay,
and we're it is interesting, especially considering what China's done in Africa. I mean, Russia, obviously, no comparison to what China's doing in Africa, but it's interesting that Russia is turning more towards Africa. And this is, again, an overlap of Russian and Chinese strategic alignment. That is probably the most...
Yes, they always do it cooperating with China.
And that is exactly what you saw targeted in Mali.
Well, you see the B... the R and the C in the BRICS involved in railroad construction, and they're all on the same page. We're going to leave it here and come back next week. I'd like to thank you guys. A pleasure as always.
All right. Talk to you in a couple weeks.
Okay, guys. You've been listening to CPR Sunday with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.